that will turn colder for the weekend.
Thank you, Steph. This is BBC Radio 4, where now our new book of the week is the newly published biography of François Mitterrand, written by the former BBC foreign correspondent Philip Short. A man famous for his ambiguity, Mitterrand served as President of France for an impressive 14 years. Henry Goodman tells his story.
Other nations have scandals. The French have affairs. From the Dreyfus Affair before the Great War, when the country was at loggerheads with itself over the supposed treason of a Jewish officer, to the affair of Bokassa's diamonds in the 1970s, which helped end the re-election hopes of President Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, and the Clearstream Affair 20 years later, when another French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, threatened to hang a rival from a butcher's hook. Affairs have punctuated the rhythms of French political life, but few have been as enduring and as insidious as the Observatory Affair. In 1959, the Algerian War of Independence was raging. De Gaulle had been called out of retirement by army commanders who, infuriated by the reluctance of the civilian government to crack down on a rebellion in what was then still officially part of France, had threatened a coup d'état. De Gaulle was given emergency powers, and a new constitution was approved, enshrining presidential rule. Among the few mainstream politicians who'd voted against de Gaulle's return was François Mitterrand, then among the leaders of the non-communist opposition. In 1944, Mitterrand had become the youngest French minister for almost a century and had held office a dozen times since. Until de Gaulle's recall, he'd been regarded, not least by himself, as a prime minister in waiting. Subsequently, he'd been marginalised. To die-hard conservatives, Mitterrand epitomised the decadence of the weak civilian leadership which seemed prepared to sell out in North Africa, as it had in French Indochina. That autumn, Paris was alive with rumours of right-wing assassination squads being sent from Algiers to execute political moderates. One of Mitterrand's closest friends informed him that death lists were circulating. Mitterrand's name was listed first. In the summer, plastic explosives were placed outside the door of his apartment, but failed to detonate. His wife, Danielle, at home alone with two young children, started getting telephone calls late at night. A voice would say, "Does black suit you?" "I hope so, because soon you will wear it for your husband." I told François, but he said it was just cranks. Nevertheless, on October the 14th, Mitterrand asked a trusted friend to find him a bulletproof jacket. The following day, Mitterrand dined at home. Afterwards, he drove to the Champs-Élysées to buy an evening paper before heading back to Saint-Germain-des-Prés for a nightcap at the Brasserie Lippe. Lippe was, and still is, a Parisian institution, a meeting place for politicians, philosophers, writers and artists from Hemingway and Jean-Paul Sartre to Verlaine and Chagall. Mitterrand was a regular. But on this occasion, he told his companions he felt tired and left. Within minutes, he said later, he sensed that he was being followed. Two men in a green Renault kept steadily behind him. To make sure he wasn't imagining things, he changed his usual route. Abruptly, I turned right into the Rue Auguste Comte, accelerating as I did so. The other car did the same and started gaining on me. Instinctively, I veered across the road, jamming on the brakes. I literally flew out of my seat, raced towards the observatory gardens, and jumped the fence, throwing myself down in a flowerbed. A volley of shots rang out, and then I saw them drive off. Mitterrand's car had seven bullet holes, which the police established had been fired from a Sten gun. Most people assume that Mitterrand had been targeted as a shot across the bows of the government, a warning to the administration that the French settlers in Algeria and their extremist leaders, the Ultras, would not sit idly by if the authorities tried to abandon them. A week later came the coup de théâtre. A former MP named Robert Pesquet, who'd represented an extreme right-wing party in Parliament, informed the investigating magistrate that the assassination attempt had been faked. Mitterrand, he said, had approached him earlier that month with a proposal that he simulate an attack in order to provoke the destruction of the Ultras and their organization. In return, Mitterrand had promised to help him relaunch his political career. Pesquet claimed he'd played along because he wanted to expose Mitterrand as a liar. Summoned by the magistrate to explain himself, Mitterrand denied everything. He said Pesquet had made the initial approach, claiming to be linked to a terrorist group which had put Mitterrand on a blacklist to be killed. Pesquet had sworn him to secrecy, he added, warning him that if his associates found out that he'd betrayed them, or if Mitterrand went to the police, his own life and the lives of his family would be in danger. On the afternoon of the attack, he'd telephoned Mitterrand to tell him the attack was imminent and promised, if he had more information, he'd be at Brasserie Lip that evening. When he didn't turn up, Mitterrand left. Pesquet had a history of shady deals. Mitterrand kept repeating to his friends, "It's his word against mine." But Pesquet had been cunning. 6 hours before the attack, he'd sent a letter to himself at a poste restante address describing what was to happen. A bailiff accompanied him when he collected it. For the press and for public opinion, it followed that Pesquet must be telling the truth, and Mitterrand was a liar. Overnight, from having been a hero, he became at best a naive dupe, at worst, an incompetent trickster. Mitterrand was a savvy, seasoned politician with a national reputation. That he could have been bamboozled by an adventurer like Pesquet seemed totally out of character. In the days after Pesquet's revelation, several of Mitterrand's inner circle thought he was close to suicide. He believed that his career was finished. For the first time since their marriage, Daniel saw him weakened. He was staring into an abyss. For nights on end, he paced up and down in the apartment, trying to figure out what to do. And years later, Mitterrand himself spoke of feeling as though I were at the bottom of a well. With a handful of exceptions, his political friends abandoned him. Salvation, of a kind, came in November, when it was disclosed that earlier in the year, Pesquet had approached Maurice Bourges-Monnery, a centre-right leader, claiming that he was to be targeted for assassination. Bourges had wisely refused to have anything to do with him. The disclosure fatally undermined Pesquet's case. If he had earlier tried to ensnare others, it was no longer credible that Mitterrand had been the one to initiate the plot. Like a soufflé that collapses once the hot air inside cools, the observatory affair began to look like the political silliness it was. 50 years later, Mitterrand's brother, Jacques, then dying of cancer, explained what had really happened. "He screwed himself completely. Pesquet," he said, "had begged Mitterrand to help him. The claim that he risked being killed if it didn't look as if he'd at least attempted an attack was an approach well calculated to appeal to the Romanesque side of Mitterrand's nature. He decided to play along. It was a gamble which, if it succeeded, would put him back in the forefront of French political life. At that time, a friend remembered De Gaulle was in the spotlight. Mitterrand was no longer center stage. So he committed this enormous, fantastic piece of stupidity." The autumn of 1959 was a watershed in Mitterrand's career. As Danielle put it shortly before her death, there was before the observatory and after. Although he'd retained a seat in Parliament, he became the whipping boy of the right. Whenever he got up to speak, his opponents would chant, "Pesky, pesky!" Politics, however, has its arsenal of surprises. 6 years later, in 1965, this same François Mitterrand achieved a resounding triumph in the first direct presidential election of the new Fifth Republic. De Gaulle's stature was such that there was never any possibility he would lose, but Mitterrand was able to force him into the humiliation of a runoff and received an unhoped-for 45% of the vote. After another 15 years in 1981, he became France's first popularly elected socialist president and then went on to win a second term. By the time he completed his mandate, he had led the country for 14 years, longer than any other French head of state in modern times, establishing himself as being, with de Gaulle, one of the two defining leaders of 20th century France. They were strange bedfellows. De Gaulle gave France back its pride after the Nazi occupation. Mitterrand, in peacetime, transformed France into a modern democratic state, legitimized the left as a responsible voice in the nation's political affairs, and, together with Helmut Kohl, pushed Europe towards political union. One was an austere, granite monument of a man. The other was an enigma, a bourgeois intellectual from a solidly right-wing background capable of firing a left-wing crowd into a fervor of political enthusiasm. De Gaulle was a good Catholic, devoted husband and father. Mitterrand was a lapsed Catholic who spent years in a ménage à trois and then maintained two homes and two families. They were chalk and cheese and, not surprisingly, allergic to each other. Laurent Fabius, Mitterrand's prime minister in the 1980s, wrote, "The key to Mitterrand's personality, to his extraordinary success, to his longevity, was his staggering and quite exceptional ambivalence, which made him view everything as both itself and its opposite. Every person as both good and bad. Every situation as containing the seeds of both tragedy and hope." The French statesman Mitterrand most admired was the 17th century Cardinal Mazarin, after whom he named his daughter Mazarine. The cardinal wrote, "Always keep in mind these five precepts: simulate, dissimulate, trust nobody, speak well of everyone, anticipate before you act." In the 1940s, Mitterrand was at Vichy and in the resistance. His personal friends ranged from communists to those who, before the war, had supported fascist groups. His ambiguity was both a strength and a weakness. The ability to see two sides of every issue prevented him from becoming sectarian, but the same mixture of agility and patience that allowed him to fashion compromises and finesse domestic crises inspired wariness and suspicion. His doctor, in the last months of his life, told him he was a mixture of Machiavelli, Don Corleone, Casanova, and the Little Prince. When Mitterrand inquired, "He knew what proportions?" the physician replied prudently, "That depends on which day."
Henry Goodman has been reading Mitterrand by Philip Short. The programme was abridged and produced by Jane Marshall Productions. This is BBC Radio 4. It's 12 minutes to 1. Now here's the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 today, Tuesday the 26th of November. There are warnings of gales in Fitzroy, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. High Shannon 1042, slow moving with little change by 1800 Tuesday. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, North Utsira. Westerly or southwesterly 4 or 5, increasing 6 or 7 at times. Occasional rain, good, becoming moderate, occasionally poor. South Utsira, southeast 40s. Northwesterly 4 or 5, backing westerly 5 or 6. Showers at first, rain later, good, becoming moderate or poor later. Northwest 40s, Cromarty 4th.